Well, good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome to tonight's talk with Will Norman. My name is Tim Edge, and I'm the Director of Development at Wilsons. This is the fourth in a series of talks aimed at bringing the Wilsons community together and providing career advice and information for our students and alumni. Now, just a few housekeeping points before we start. Please keep your cameras and microphones switched off during the session. If you have any questions, please save them until the end. I will then ask you to use the raise hand facility to indicate that you have a question, and I will then select you and ask you to unmute and ask your question. We will be recording the talk, and the intention is that the recording will be put on the school's website and our alumni engagement platform, which is called Wilsons AlumNet. Okay, it now gives me very great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Will Norman. Will has been the Mayor of London's Walking and Cycling Commissioner for almost 5 years, during which time he's been working incredibly hard to help Londoners to become more physically active and to make London's streets much safer for cyclists. I'm delighted that Will is with us tonight to tell us about his career path and the valuable work he is doing. Will, welcome, and over to you.
Thanks ever so much, Tim, and thank you everybody for joining, well, for letting me come and speak to you today. I'm really sorry we can't do this in person, so hopefully at some point soon we're going to move away from the online talks and be able to see each other face to face, because these things are always better when you can see people. But thanks ever again. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm going to talk a little bit about my career in social research and social science, and talk a bit about my current job and the jobs I've had to sort of get to this point. I'd quite like to just reflect a bit on why I think this is a worthwhile career path to consider. And as Tim said, he asked me if I had any tips or recommendations. I think the way he put it was things I wish I had done differently. Now, that's a very long list of things I wish I'd done differently in life. But we've only got an hour, but I'd be really happy to share some of my tips and suggestions for people thinking starting out in their career at an early stage. So who am I? I'm Will Norman. I'm the Mayor of London's Walking and Cycling Commissioner. My job is pretty straightforward in that respect, in that my job is to get more people walking and cycling around the city. I've been doing it for the last 5 years. And, it's worth sort of stepping back a bit and think, well, why have I got this job? Why does the mayor want to change the way that we move around the city? And I think this comes back to my background in social science. If you look at some of the challenges London faces, we have the most inactive generation in history, most inactive kids in the country live in London. Now, this isn't one of my kids. This isn't my son, my 14-year-old son in lockdown, but it did look like him playing a lot of Xbox and a lot of PlayStation. But we do have a problem with physical inactivity that leads to all sorts of problems with diabetes and heart disease and other challenges. London also has a massive problem with air pollution. Sadly, about 4,000 people every year die from the effects or die early because of the effects of air pollution. We sadly have 4,000 more people a year involved in being hurt on our roads, being killed or seriously injured on our roads, something that we have to make those roads safer for people walking, people cycling, people using motorbikes. And finally, the big one, climate change. It's here. We know we're seeing the effects here in London with floods and extreme weather, but we're also seeing the effects all around the world. And 25% of London's carbon emissions come from transport. So part of my job is trying to help people shift some of those journeys that people make from cars to cleaner, greener forms of transport. How do I do that? Well, we use an awful lot of data and research, which comes back to the background in social science, to think, where should we build cycle routes? Where will people use them? Who uses them? Where are the best places to put them? And then I work very closely with councils and communities around the city to build cycle routes, to put in crossings where people are wanting to cross the road, helping schools put in crossings outside their roads, trying to reduce the number of people who are hurt and encourage more people to be active. But I'm not here this evening to talk about cycle lanes or just cycle lanes. I'm here to talk a bit about my career. So I thought a good way of doing this would be to start off by asking a very straightforward question, which what is social science? And it's a tricky one because a lot of people, when I was at school, I didn't know what a social science was. I knew what a science was. I did biology, physics, and I do know what a science is, I promise you. I did biology, chemistry and physics throughout the school. But a social science is a bit different. In its broadest sense, a social science is a study of society and the manner in which people behave and the way we as people influence the world around us. It's the sciences that help explain how society works. It answers questions like, well, what are the causes of unemployment, or what makes economic growth, or how and why do people vote the way they do? What makes people happy? And all of this information, the data that this science generates, is really important for shaping the way that governments think, the way that businesses think and work, the way that policymakers, the way that councils, the way that charities, that non-governmental organizations work. So it's such an important part of the decision making that sort of shapes our society and shapes our world. But when I was back at, I grew up in Bristol. I did my A-levels were geography, biology and classical civilizations. I didn't know any of that at the time. I didn't know what a social science was. But I just sort of illustrate some of those social sciences that you might have heard of. So human geography, how humans affect the world around them, so for example, environmental change, is a good example of a social science you might well be doing at school. Economics, politics, psychology. This obviously psychology is the study of the human mind. Sociology, the study of people rather than just individuals. Social anthropology, which is the sort of study of human societies and how social structures are organized and understood. So there are a vast array of different social sciences, most of which sort of begin to get taught in detail at university. But I'll talk through a bit about my career and how I got to this big point. So, as I said, I grew up in Bristol. I did those A-levels, but I was really fortunate that I took a year off after A-levels and I got an opportunity to work as a volunteer in Cairo. I had a job in a mother and child health clinic. Now, I knew nothing about mother and children's health in this role, but it was funded by the British government. And as part of the arrangement that they had as the funding, it was to fund, they had to also help not just poor Egyptians in a poor neighborhood in Cairo, but also to help refugees from the Horn of Africa, from the war in Somalia, the wars in Sudan that were going on at the moment, and the wars in Ethiopia. And the problem was that the refugees didn't trust the Egyptian staff and the Egyptians didn't trust the refugees. So my sole asset at that point, my sole job, the only point that made me qualified that I wasn't Egyptian and I wasn't a refugee, and therefore I was the person who worked between these different groups. And although I was a volunteer and I was just straight out of school, I did learn an awful lot about how of a workplace. I learned how international development begins to work in a different country. I had experience of living in a different city, which was brilliant. I went on to do social anthropology, which is one of those social sciences talked about, both at Edinburgh University, but also then further again in London School of Economics. Now, social anthropology is how human society works, how the social structure works, how societies, cultures, groups of people are organized, they're understood, and the way that plays out. And my first job off the back of this was in Mozambique. I was interested in a career in international development, and I went to Mozambique. And Mozambique had just finished having a civil war that was tragic, and it had finished, thankfully. But it was a very long civil war. And a lot of the cattle that were absolutely critical for people's livelihoods and they in rural areas, they were used to work the fields like this guy, and they were used as food and as a resource for communities. During the war, quite a lot of these were stolen and killed. So we worked on a job that was restocking cattle at the end of the Civil War. Now, this project had lots of vets and experts on animals, but they'd sort of focused so much on the animals, they'd forgotten the people involved in this. And as I said, social science is all about the study of society and how people behave. And so my job was to really understand how did the animals and the peoples come together. And if we're going to restock cattle, How do we set up a credit system? How do we redistribute them? How do we work with local communities and villages to make sure that this is sustainable? And it worked. The approach that we took was something that was adopted by the Mozambican government and has been taken on by, or some of the approaches were taken on by the Mozambican government, and some of them ended up being used in other African countries as well, in other circumstances. And after that job, I sort of got, one, I fell in love with the country, and I went on and I did a PhD. I went and lived in this mud hut. I spent 18 months doing research in a village. I built this mud hut myself. It was a truly terrible mud hut. There was one old man who walked 40 kilometers just to come and laugh at my mud hut. When it rained, all the mud fell off. So it was really a hut full of sticks. But my research was in this area, looking at labor migration, looking at cross-border conservation. So where I was, the countries were putting in a wildlife park, and how this was affecting local people. And I went on, I did my PhD, but I realized at the end of this that I thought I would wanted to become an academic. I thought that when I started the process, I might want to go and work in universities, or I might want to work in international development. But I realized by the end of it, I didn't want to do that. So I came out of my degree. I got this stupid outfit to graduate in. And this outfit wasn't the reason why I didn't want to go on and be an academic. But I didn't really feel like wanting to wear that again. And so I was stuck in a situation. So I've done this degree. I've started my career. I've had two jobs working in this space. What should I do now? And with my friend Robin here, we decided that we would start up a research company. We did it, and we would use our research skills, we would use our social science to try and help companies and governments think up solutions to some of their problems. And we set up this small company that grew and grew, and we ended up doing some really interesting work. One of our clients was Microsoft. We worked with Microsoft to spend time with people who work in software, in IT, all around the world, and understand how Microsoft can better help their problem, these people's challenges and problems in the workplace. We spent time asking them what they thought of the Microsoft products and how they could be improved. And then we'd take that information back to Microsoft and work with the teams at Microsoft on how they can further develop their products, whether it's Word or Microsoft Office or some of the software, the technical support services that they provided. We also worked with Nokia on the first range of mobile phones that ever had music on them, and the first range of mobile phones that ever had videos on them. Now, I know this is a long time ago for many of you, but this at the time was cutting edge technology. And we worked with Nokia looking at how people used these and what they thought of them in India, Australia, in America, in Mexico, in the UK, in Italy. And we took that information and we went back to Nokia to help make those products better. Similarly, we did similar stuff with consumer brands. So we worked with Unilever, one of the big companies that sells hair products, and this was Vaseline, but this was in South Africa. And this was trying to help understand what people thought of their products and how they might do an advertising campaign and how they might better reach the sort of markets that they wanted to do. So all of this was based on using those social science skills of talking to people, understanding people, and how they related to these different projects. I think the weirdest job I ever had was that when we were running this business was working with Dunkin' Donuts, and we spent weeks in trying to understand why Dunkin' Donuts was successful in Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and Berlin. And it was a very, very weird time, particularly Saudi Arabia. But it was again using those social science skills. It wasn't just big companies we worked for. One of the most interesting things that we did for them was in Belfast. It was a time when the peace process had been working its way through, and we worked with communities on both sides of the conflict area in Belfast to understand how they saw space, how they used space, where they felt they were safe, where they felt they were unsafe. And all of that was how the city could help redevelop and how they might change the city, and working with planners and builders and architects to reshape that city. So I ran that company for a while and really enjoyed it, but quite a lot of it, because with Dunkin' Donuts or Unilever or Nokia, we're traveling all over the world. When I had my first child, I decided to sell my half, and I went on and did the same sort of work, but for a charity, an organization called the Young Foundation. The Young Foundation has an amazing history. It was named after this guy called Michael Young, who was part of the team who invented the welfare state, so the NHS and our welfare system in government at the end of the war, the end of the Second World War, and then got frustrated with working in government and decided that he could do more outside of government. And he started the Open University, he started Witch magazine, he started a wonderful service called Language Line, which was an idea if you're you don't speak English and you go into a hospital, there's likely that the hospital won't have someone who speaks your language, but they can call up a number and you can speak to someone who does speak your language, who can act as a translation. And Michael's approach to this was always to understand communities, to spend time doing that social science in those communities, and then come up with the good ideas and ideas to help solve those problems. So I came in as director of research, and we spent time in communities understanding how we could improve services, how we could solve problems. So we worked with, we did a big project on teenage pregnancy and how we can better provide services for teenagers in some parts of the country, and hopefully reduce the prevalence of teenage pregnancy. Or if there was teenage pregnancy, how do we better care for people? Similarly, we did a whole piece of work on employment services. So we hung out with young people who were unemployed, and their experiences of the unemployment services and how could those be improved? What could be done? What more could be done to get people back into work? The most interesting thing I did, I think, was spending time we did nights in the life of night workers. So we hung out with people who fixed the tube, these guys. We hung out with the police, the people who worked in kebab shops, security guards, the ambulance guys, casualty, all these different people who worked at night, who we found that a lot of their needs were not being addressed. So they didn't have, all the shops were closed, they didn't have food, the canteens were closed, they were more likely to get hurt in a car accident on the way home because they were tired. So we started changing the way that government organizations and companies provide for their night shift workers. And as we go into a 24-hour society, you know, more and more into a 24-hour society, these needs are particularly important. One of the things I did at the Young Foundation was get interested in health, and particularly around kids. And one day I was talking to somebody who worked for Nike about the problems of people being inactive and the challenges of physical inactivity, people moving around less, and how that was affecting the country's health. And they got interested, and we did a brilliant piece of work looking at just how this inactivity crisis has become global. All around the world, you're finding that people are getting increasingly less active. We've designed physical activity out of our lives. And obviously for a company like Nike, physical activity is important. It's important that people are active to buy their shoes, but also for their, you know, they're not entirely a heartless bunch of capitalists. There were a lot of people who really cared about the impact it was having on the health and well-being of so many people. So we launched the team that I worked with, and I came on board, and we launched a program, a campaign called Design to Move, of how do we get people to move more. We were focusing on early positive experiences for kids. So how do we get kids more active? But also, how do we integrate physical activity into everyday life? And my job in all of this was to work with academics, social scientists and scientists, governments, cities, United Nations agencies. So I worked with the World Health Organization, UNESCO, NGOs, to build partnerships between Nike and ourselves of how we could work together on this. And I spent 3 or 4 years talking to all these people, telling people what to do, and telling, sort of suggesting, coming up with ideas on how you can get more people active. And then the mayor came along and said, well, you should stop telling people how to do it and you should start doing it yourself. Nike's slogan is just do it. So how about you start just doing it, which is exactly how I came to be in the role I am today. And we've been rolling out cycle lanes and trying to get people more active across the city. So I hope that that sort of journey that I've been on gives a flavour of some of the things that you can do with a social science degree, and maybe why you might consider doing social sciences at A-levels and beyond. I thought I was sort of, as I was thinking through the talk, I was thinking about, well, how could I convince people that this is a good thing to do? Why have I done social science? Why have I stuck with it? Why am I still interested in it? And I think I sort of came down to the idea that actually it makes you think differently about the world. I think it makes you question how things are. I think it's, you know, you can have all the data, the hard science in the world, all this chemistry and all the creating, you know, it's a good example, the COVID situation. You can develop the vaccine and the brilliant scientists have come up with the vaccine. But how do you understand how you get the vaccine out there? How do we, why are people not wanting to get vaccinated? How do we manage this? So actually understanding how society works, or how institutions work, how people work, how cultures work, is actually essential for actually driving change in society. The science for climate change is out there now. We know that the climate change is real, all the data is there. But the thing we're going to need now is to get people and societies and governments and countries and companies to change to address that problem. So for me, the social science is the bit that actually leads to, it converts that, a lot of that knowledge, that maybe some of the hard science and facts, into action. And for me, I've always wanted to use the work that I do to drive change, to improve things, to come up with new ways of thinking, to address some of those challenges in society. So if it was in Mozambique doing stuff with agriculture, it was like, how do we restock cattle? How do we get the rural communities working again? In working with the Young Foundation, it's like, how do we change government policy? How do we get better services for people? How do we make them more efficient? How do we make sure that the money is being spent is doing a better job? At Nike, it was like, how do we get a company the size and the scale and as influential as Nike to drive a change that is better for society? How do I use this company to engage cities and countries and academics to think differently about things? And that continues today. You know, the work that I do today is about changing travel behaviors, thinking how can people use a greener, cleaner way of getting around rather than just use their cars. And so I suppose, so reflecting on my job, it doesn't have to be, as I hope that's come across, that social science doesn't just have to be an academic thing. It's very practical and it leads to change in society. You don't have to think of it as just working for charities or in government. It's huge. You know, businesses need these skill sets. There are jobs out there and people hungry to bring on people. So you can use this approach in so many different ways. And so if you are interested in this, Mr. Edge asked me if I could sort of think through some of the tips or ideas that might be helpful for people thinking about going about into this. And I suppose I was thinking back over my career and trying to think, well, actually, what tips would I have? What would I do differently? And I think one of the most important things is to get some experience, whatever it is. I was once interviewing for a job and somebody had they had 4 A stars at A level and they had got a first class degree and they had got a PhD and they had got a master's, but they had never had a job. And I sort of thought, actually, you need to get experience in the real world. Why not work, you know, working, whether it's working in a supermarket or a paper round or a holiday job, whatever it might be, I it's so important to gain these skills. And it's amazing with those jobs that you might have in university holidays, or after school or around there, you build up so many skill sets that you don't know that will be useful. So for example, when I was at university, I got a job in a bar. I was a terrible barman, really terrible barman, but the manager asked me, you don't seem very good at being a barman. You've just dropped that cocktail bottle that you were trying to make, but maybe you'd be better helping me with some of the accounts. So I worked in the accounts department for a summer. And I, from that, it gave me a grounding in doing the books. And when I started running my own business, I had to use that skill set I started applying that in my own life, and it saved me an absolute fortune, and actually gave me an idea on how to run the books. Another tip I would have is, you know, don't think about working in different sizes of organizations. For me, when I've worked in small organizations, I've got all sorts of different skills, because largely they don't have the people. You know, when I worked at Nike, there was an advertising department, an accounts department, a marketing department, a press department, the X, Y, and Z. Whereas in a small company, you know, when I worked at the Young Foundation, I worked for myself, you had to apply yourself to all sorts of different things. And, you know, if you didn't know how to fix your computer, then it wouldn't get fixed. So you learned how to do that sort of things yourselves. So I think certainly those are things. I suppose another key thing I would suggest is trying things. And I hope that my career path is sort of showed that I've done all sorts of different things. And when I started out, I didn't know what I wanted to do. When I was at university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Frankly, I don't really know what I want to do now. I'm interested in things. I'm always curious. But I think it's so important to try some different things, to see what you enjoy. Go for the things at university you find interesting. If you're passionate about something, you find an interest, then you know you'll do well if you're interested in something. And then try and do the same approach for finding a job. It's like, well, what am I interested in? What am I enjoying? You won't know. You know who at the age of 17, 18 has ever become an economist? But actually, you might like being an economist, or you might want to go into politics, or you might want to work for an NGO that's driving human rights campaigning. You won't know until you've tried some of these things. And the more things you try, the more you'll be able to refine and find what you find passionate, what you find rewarding, and what's helpful. But as you go about that, build up your own story. Build up your own story, whether it's your bar job or working in a cafe or volunteering at a tennis club or whatever you're doing now. But think about the experiences you're gaining and build up your own story, so that when somebody asks you, you know, what can you do? What can you do? You know, what experiences you've got? You've got a story to tell, bringing together some of these experiences. So what I tend to do: get a notebook, get a Word document a document on your Google Drive or whatever it might be. And just keep on writing the things that you think are your successes, so that over your life, when you come to write a CV, when you come to get a job interview, you've got those things that actually, I was really successful at this, or I'm proud of that, and build up that story of your successes, of what you're interested in and what you've done. And if you start doing that now and you start looking around for those experiences, talking to people to get some of those experiences, I think you'll be set up for life. I could go on and on, but I will actually go for questions rather than carry on talking. So thank you for listening. I hope this has been interesting, but I wonder if it's better taking some questions at this point rather than just listen to me go on and on. Tim, what do you think?
Thank you, Will. That was fantastic. Really brilliant. And to our audience, if you have a question for Will, could you please raise your hand virtually, and then I will select you and invite you to unmute yourself. So the first question we have is from Sam Whiting. Sam, can you please unmute yourself and ask your question?
Okay. Hi, Will. Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I'm a biologist by training, so it's always nice to know more about the social sciences. I work with a lot of our students that want to do medicine and dentistry, and I have a particular interest in health inequality. And I wondered if you might be able to sort of talk a little bit about to what extent you use information about health inequalities in your current job. Because it seems to me that throughout your career, you've got a lot of experience in identifying inequalities and then obviously devising sort of solutions to close some of those gaps and put in sort of, you know, practical measures. And obviously, we want to encourage physical activity amongst the population, but there's not necessarily equal access to physical activity for all. So I wondered if you might be able to perhaps share an example or a success story of ways in which perhaps you've tried to close or, you know, narrow some of those inequalities.
Thanks, Sam. That's a really good question. You're absolutely right. There are massive health inequalities within London. And actually, I think those health inequalities have been highlighted further throughout COVID. What we found is those existing inequalities have been amplified over the past 12 months. And very sadly, so communities that have got those health disadvantages, but also other inequalities around might be socioeconomic inequalities, or people with disabilities, for example, have fared worse during this process. So part of the, I started off saying that as part of my job at the moment, we use an awful lot of data to make decisions. And there's a wonderful phrase that came from, it's an American statistician, but it was Michael Bloomberg, who used to be the mayor of New York, used to say, "In God we trust," which is written on every American banknote. "In God we trust, but everyone else needs to bring data." Yeah. And I use that approach myself. So for health inequalities, it's one of the factors that we take into account when we're awarding funding to local authorities to make changes. So we have a whole list of things. Part of this is, well, actually, is the quality good enough? Is something connecting, you know, does this make sense in terms of a transport route? But actually, we are now focusing some of our decision making on making sure that the changes go on into some of the physical infrastructure changes happen within those communities that have got the greatest disadvantages. Because if you're physically active, you're better off in terms of every aspect of your health and your mental health. If you're physically active, I think it's 20% less likely to die of all-cause mortality. So you're less likely to get it, most of the diseases that will eventually kill you. And in terms of diabetes, in terms of chronic heart disease, other challenges, that's really important. So we use that data to shape our infrastructure, but that isn't enough, in my view. We know that some communities are more disadvantaged. So we now have a grants program to provide funding for projects that get more people walking, cycling in communities that are particularly affected by health inequalities. So, for example, there's a project with Muslim women in the East London working with the mosques and the faith and places of worship to enable more people to start walking, cycling, and being active in those communities. Now, that's a direct connection to doing the research on the health inequalities, thinking that you need the infrastructure in these areas, but just building the infrastructure on our own isn't enough. You then need to actually have community engagement, work with people to make a difference. So coming back to your original point about having medicine and the interest in medicine and dentistry, you know, it's so important that people are trained as medics and dentists, but then you also need to recognize some of those broader population issues of where sort of efforts should be most targeted to address those inequalities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam. And do we have any more questions from the floor? Yes, Patrick.
Hi, Will. Thanks so much for giving us that amazing talk. It's so valuable for our students and parents to hear from you. Such an interesting career, and really, really useful for students to hear about social sciences and courses that they haven't heard of and types of jobs that they would otherwise perhaps never hear about. The question I had was about when you come across young people at work, perhaps recent graduates, what are the things about them that impress you other than their academic qualifications, which I suppose is another way of asking, you know, what sort of things are you looking for in young people when it comes to giving them a job other than their fantastic academic accomplishments, which most of our students or all of our students will have?
Thanks, Patrick. Well, you know, if I'm completely honest, I'm in awe of young people, or most young people today. The young graduates that we have coming in through our organisation are so much better at so many things than I was at that age, and I know that so many people are going to be successful for the future. You're right, the academic qualifications are important, but that is not the whole picture, and that's certainly not the whole picture of things that I look for when I'm wanting to employ people or if I want people on my team. I think one of the most important things is being able to demonstrate a passion, a commitment, an energy about something that you're interested in. And it doesn't need to be, you know, I wouldn't want to say, OK, I'm only going to employ people who are passionate about cycling, for example. Actually, what you want to see is people who are passionate and interested in things. And it could be anything. But having that passion and interest and that curiosity, that for me is such an important character trait to actually make people part of a team. I will only work with people who are interested in things. They're always wanting to find out more, because no matter how good your academic qualifications are, that it's never enough. You can never know enough. And that constant questioning, well, why is that working like that? Thinking, well, you know, why have you always done it like that? And I think that's one of the most important things that young graduates and young people can bring to organizations. People like me, 5 years into the job, can be a bit stuffy. We can always think we're doing things the right way, but it's not always the case. So it's really important that people who coming in do ask the questions. They say, well, why do you do it like that? And question some of the systems that are there, because that's the only way we're going to improve things. So I would say a sense of curiosity, a sense of passion, and a questioning of the way things are being done is always healthy, because I think that's the way that we can actually improve things.
Thanks so much, Will. That's really useful to hear.
Thank you very much indeed, Patrick. Will, somebody here in the room has scribbled on a piece of paper, where does Will stand on e-scooters?
E-scooters. So e-scooters are, for those people, I'm sure everybody's seen them out on the street. So e-scooters are currently illegal to be used on our roads and our pavements. It's legal to buy them in this country, but it's not legal to use them, which I think one of the problems here is that most people are unaware of the law. Now, these laws are set up by national government, so it's an issue that's affected by Whitehall. My own personal view is, at the moment, because there is no regulation around them, a lot of them are unsafe. So, for example, I saw one yesterday or 2 days ago that could do 56 miles an hour. Now, that's an insane speed to be able to do on a scooter. Some of them don't have brakes, some of them don't have lights, and yet you can buy them. So what I want is the government to bring in rules to make sure, well, look, this is an e-scooter and this is the speed it should do. It should have lights, it should have brakes. The second thing I want to do is make sure that people don't use them on pavements, because I think they're dangerous on pavements, and when people have got visual impairments, for example, or older people, or people with pushchairs and kids and dogs, they're unsafe. And then the third thing I want to do is be able to make sure that cities can, if there's a hire scheme, then cities can regulate those hire schemes. So the law needs to change. And that's one of the reasons why in London we've started doing a trial of trying to figure out, well, if they need to be safer, how do we do them safer? So we have a rental trial that's approved by government. And that's, for example, that caps the speed at 12 and a half miles an hour. You've got a number plate on these things. You've got insurance. So there are a whole load of things that need to change to make them safer, because frankly, at the moment, the law's not working. They're unsafe, and people are buying these things without really understanding the consequences because they're not being told.
Thank you very much indeed, Will. Rayanch, you have a question.
So with social sciences, you work a lot with people. So how has your job been affected by COVID and the fact that you can't actually meet people a lot?
That is a really, really good question. It's been really hard. You're the first person who's asked me that. It's been really hard. You know, I think that, as you're right, so much of my work is with people. In this job, a lot of it is spending time out and about, understanding what's working, what isn't, talking to people who are cycling, talking to people who don't like cycling, working with schools to see how people can get more people to walk or cycle or to skateboard to school or what have you. And that's much harder on screens like this, which is why I said at the beginning, I really wish that we were doing this face to face, because it's a much easier way of doing it. That said, there are advantages to doing this. You know, I it would have taken me quite a long time to come down to Wilson's and talk to you. So it is possible to do this and fit things in around. So there are, you know, I'm always trying to find And coming out of this, I can't, you know, I'm spending more time in the office, I'm spending more time talking to people, but I'm also using the technology more. So there are always opportunities in times like this. Do you think, actually, I could improve the way I work using the computer more? But Rania, I think you're completely right that I've struggled a bit not being able to see people as much as I usually do, because it's as you said, it's such an important part of my work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. And we have a question from Arav.
Hi, actually I'm Arav's mum, but he's here with me.
Hi, Arav's mum.
Yes, you know, he's in year 9 actually, and this is the first career talk actually that he's listening to. And it's really interesting. My question was actually, because you work a lot, I mean, your team and company works a lot with data, do you also then employ quite a few sort of data analysts or scientists? And do you also then, you know, is there any AI ML in your sector as well?
Yes. You know, well, one, from an analyst perspective in year 9, my advice would be don't narrow down your options too early, because, you know, as I said earlier, it takes a while to figure out what you want to do later on in life. So go with the things you're interested in and the things you enjoy at school. In terms of that data question, this is absolutely essential. We do have data scientists who work for us. We are using more AI. So one of the most important things that sort of comes into my job is actually just the sheer act of counting. So we count cars, we count buses, we count the number of people on buses, we count the number of cyclists, we count the number of pedestrians. And all of this, you know, when I started the job, people were on the street, literally counting the number of people walking up and down a street, which is crazy. So we have brought in artificial intelligence to do some of that counting and getting that raw data. And then from that data, we can begin to model. Well, if we put in a zebra crossing here, or if we put in a crossing here, what effect might that have on the traffic? What effect might it have on the pedestrians? So much of the way that we help make the decisions is based on data, and increasingly with areas of artificial intelligence, which I think is really exciting. But ultimately, the data only goes so far. And quite often, there are always trade-offs. There are always difficult decisions to be made. So ultimately, the decision is always a human decision. It's informed by data, but it isn't made by data. So one of the skills that I think is increasingly important in the workplace is, even if you're not a data scientist, it's being able to ask the right questions of data scientists. It's being able to understand what the data scientists are telling you. And from the data scientists' perspective, being able to communicate what they do to people who aren't experts, because frankly, I'm not an expert, but I am the decision maker. Or the mayor is not necessarily an expert on artificial intelligence, but he will be the decision maker. So the ability to communicate, the ability to be able to explain what's going on, the ability to tell those stories, to bring it to life to a non-expert audience is, I think, an increasingly important part of the skills needed in the modern economy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Will. I've got an off-the-wall question here. Which is, will there be Ride London in 2022?
Yes, it's the last weekend of May. The route has changed. So Ride London is a cycle event that's happened. It's the world's biggest celebration of cycling. Over 100,000 people usually take part in the event. You can come into central London and ride through sort of car-free streets around Buckingham Palace and in sort of iconic sites, but there are also longer rides for people who are interested in going further. There's a 100-mile ride. For a long time, we had a partnership with Surrey, so that went out through the sort of Surrey Hills, but Surrey don't want to be part of it anymore, so we've had to pause a bit for COVID for 2 years, but is coming back with a vengeance in 2022. Will be a new route, so it will be going out through Essex and North London, so it's switching sides for a bit. It looks just as exciting. And one of the things we're really keen to do with Ride London is use it as a mechanism of encouraging new people to try cycling, to take it up, to maybe raise some money for charity and think about doing it. So have a look on the TFL website, have a look at the, if you Google Ride London, you can find out a bit more about it and how you might be able to get a place.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, Darshan, you've got a question.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. I'm Darshan's dad. He's here.
Hi, Darshan's dad.
Hi. I work in a district general hospital, and I always felt, I've been in the sector for about 25 years. I've always felt, we know there's a big health inequality, even in England, across the, from north to south.
Yeah.
But I've felt that there's a big postcode lottery in terms of what trust can deliver to you in the hour of need. How do we kind of address that issue? I know it's a bigger question in terms of Department of Health, et cetera, but this postcode lottery is something which has bothered me for many, 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 many years. And I'm not sure what the government has plans to kind of tackle it.
Yeah, so I agree with you that this is a problem, and it's been a problem for a long time. I'm not an expert in terms of what the government are going to do about it, but I do think I know some of the reasons, some of the ways we might be able to help help change the situation. And I think it comes back to something that was mentioned earlier around the data. And I'm a huge fan of data being open and people being able to see the transparency of the data. And I think all too often, we hear the phrase postcode lottery for service provision, but we don't actually know what that actually means. So the sort of being able to, I strongly feel that the hospitals need to publish more of the information that they have to show what a postcode lottery means in practice. And part of that is data, but part of that is also telling the stories of how people are affected. So the statistics are important, the raw data is important, but that doesn't necessarily bring it to life. And I think to engage a public conversation around things, to actually genuinely change things and get people thinking differently, you need the data, but you also need the stories of what that means to individuals. So, for example, you know, does that mean that cancer treatments in some parts of the country are not being provided to people? So that means that you could, you know, does that mean that somebody's grandmother or someone's mum hasn't been able to have the treatment that they've been able to have, whereas in another place, that's exactly what they did have and they were able to bring that cancer into remission, for example. So for me, I think it's a really important part of not just within health, but actually highlighting any inequalities and thinking about how do I change things? I'm frustrated with this. How do I change things? I think such an important part of this is having the data, but also then being able to tell the stories, the real life examples, because that's what makes journalists sit up and pay attention to it. That's what makes people think, well, actually, that just isn't fair. Why is my grandma in London able to get that treatment, but my sister-in-law's grandma in Manchester isn't being able to have that treatment? That just isn't fair. So I hope that sort of indicates a bit of how I think we need to, how you use, coming back to the social science piece, how you need to use the sort of quantitative and the data side, but also the human stories to be able to drive social change.
Thank you very much for your answer. The thing which puzzles me is that this data is available, actually, and it's widely kind of accessible. And I'm not sure how the sensitivity of the nature of the information I disclose. And I don't know which forum to address this. And I personally feel we as a country are collecting data on everything. And probably this is available on a public domain. So the question is, how do we act upon it now?
Yeah, so I think that I agree with you that so the data being available is one thing, but then how does it get used? And that's where sort of campaign groups, and I come back to the storytelling that, you know, how do you make this attractive for newspapers and journalists to be able to think, oh, there's a story here, this will interest people, and how do we make data that's open and available spark an interest? Because, you know, one thing I've learned in this job and previous jobs, that it is only through public pressure that a lot of politicians will drive change and will make a change. And it takes a lot of work, actually, to make that happen. And the data and the evidence itself is not enough to make change happen. That's why you need campaigners, you need data, you need good examples of how things and suggestions of solutions. So it's not an easy process. I wish just having the data available would solve it, but it needs it's sort of part of a bigger process of campaigning that makes a difference.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. And any more? Well, thank you, Will, for a wonderfully entertaining and informative talk. You're hugely enthusiastic and positive, which I think is a great strength. And there's one thing you said in particular, which had a certain resonance with me. It was along the lines of make something you are passionate about your job. And I think that's just so important and so wise. So thank you. We are really grateful to you. And if anyone listening has any further questions or thinks of a question later that they wish they'd asked, then please email them to me, te@wilsons.etc. If you don't mind, Will, I will forward your questions. If normally there are a couple after the event, I'll forward those questions on to you. If you're happy to address,
I'd be delighted to. And thank you ever so much, everyone, for coming, and thanks for the good questions.
Thank you. And if anyone in the audience can suggest a speaker as good as Will, that would be great. You won't succeed, but if you can.
You can get better than me. Of course you can.
Have a try. So to all of you, thank you for being there. And thank you, Will.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Will.
Pause recording.